The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
When Suji was reading through that passage, my suspicion is those of you who are budding preachers was looking at it saying, how would I preach that? Don't worry, I've been doing the same thing. What's also been tricky about this is the last 3 months since I knew I had this passage, the actual passage that I've been scheduled to preach on has sort of floated around. The first time I was told I was preaching, well, the passage I was given was chapter 47, 13 through to the end of the chapter, and I said to Larry, it sort of, you know, doesn't quite make sense. And he looked at it and said, oh yeah, well, that's probably not much good. So he shifted it to, as I have it here, Genesis 46, 28 through to the end of chapter 46 and then into 47, 12. I noticed today the reading excluded that section at the end of 46. Fortunately, what I prepared is still is in 47, so we're covered, we're okay. In fact, as you were mulling over this problem of you budding preachers, of how would you preach this, I've partially solved the problem by narrowing it down to text that a part of the text which I think I can perhaps manage half decent sermon on. It's just verses 5 to 7, or even parts of verses 5 to 7, out of chapter 47. Let me just read from that the part that I want to focus on. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Let your father and your brothers live in the best part of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And then the text goes on and finishes off. So Joseph brought Jacob his father to Pharaoh, and he made him stand before Pharaoh. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh. That's my text. Of all the things that were possible over the last 3 months, we've got it down to three words. That's relevant. That actually is going to help me in the end solve another problem. What makes a good sermon? I haven't been to a preaching class in umpteen years. You'll be able to tell that after this. I talked to Rich Craven about this, and Rich says, you preach with authority. That's good. That's fine, Rich. You can do it. And Rich, I know you do preach with authority, and I really appreciate when you do. Preaching with authority actually helps if you've made concrete... You need to be decisive. You need to look at a text and say, I know what this means. It's clear to me. And then that decisiveness helps you be authoritative in your preaching. I get student evaluations at the end of each semester, and I get to read them. And one evaluation that's cropped up once or twice, three or four times perhaps, is Professor Green should come down from the fence. Those of you who have had me know what I'm talking about there. I like to sort of say, well, it could mean this and it could mean that, and often just sort of sit there and don't have to make a decision. It's not a luxury that preachers have. In fact, I have a friend who's a preacher who says, yeah, you look at a text, the exegetical problems are there, you split them 55-45, but then you get up and preach as if the thing that you saw as being 55% likely is actually 95% likely. That's actually hard for me to do. So... be authoritative. Okay, maybe I'll try to do that. One thing, good sermons have lots of illustrations. And those of you who were here yesterday in chapel heard Pete Enns give a really good sermon. I really enjoyed it on Psalm 73. And he drew sermon illustrations from his family life. I think, oh, yeah, I could do that, except I'm seeing Rosemary sitting there at the back. And the fact that she's sitting there at the back with Adelaide probably is a comment on how much time I spend at home with my family, that they have to come here to hear me preach in chapel to spend time with me. Most of you know I probably spend more time in my little cubicle in the basement of the library than I do at home, so I can't draw applications from my family life. I sort of don't have any. I guess another thing I could do is just do the right thing and have a three-point sermon. That's what a good sermon is, isn't it? Yeah. And as luck would have it, I've got a three-point sermon. And this is going to start to sound like Moses Silver's exegesis of Old Mother Hubbard. Some of you have heard it, and those who haven't, bear with me on this. It's the text, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And my 3 points are Jacob, number two, blessed, number three, Pharaoh. They're my 3 points. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. I'm an Old Testament type, and we're exegeting this from the Hebrew. I did, in fact, read it. And those of you who are familiar with this text in Hebrew know that it says, Vayabarak Yaakov et Paro. And we're going to do our 3 points in the order of the Hebrew, which is, my 3 points then are, blessed, number one, number two, Jacob, number three, Pharaoh. So you can make sense of all this. My first point is, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now, you all know, or you should know, the background to this statement. If you hear that word blessed, you're going to know that that's referring back to the promise that God first made to Abraham way back in chapter 12 of Genesis. And there, as part of the promise that God gives to Abraham, the Lord sets out the rules of engagement for future interaction between the elect seed of Abraham and the Gentiles. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Every time they bump into one of the descendants of Abraham, Gentiles have got a choice. They can either bless them or curse them. And in many ways, the rest of the patriarchal narratives and the rest of the Pentateuch as a whole just starts to play with these rules, this promise, and how it works itself out in practice. And in our text, at least the one that I've chosen here, we have a clear echo of Genesis 12:3. We don't have to think too hard about how Genesis 12:3 is working here in this chapter. Here we have a patriarch, Joseph, the grandson of Abraham, and he's blessing a Gentile king. Therefore, that king has evidently blessed the Abrahamic seed, Jacob, Joseph, in some way. So what is it that Pharaoh has done to merit this blessing? And simply beyond being blessed in some generic sense, what specific blessings fall on Pharaoh? Now, the first question we could look at here is, what does a Gentile have to do to get blessed? Or how does a Gentile, to put the question in the language of chapter 12, how does a Gentile bless the elect seed? Now, there doesn't appear to be one single approved method in Genesis. You can bless the seed of Abraham in one of a number of different ways. One way is to do what Pharaoh did in that first meeting that he had with Joseph, and that is to elevate this Abrahamic descendant to a position of high authority. That's a way of blessing Abraham, or at least blessing his seed. Sometimes the Gentiles might bless the patriarch by making a covenant that ensures a peace between the two groups involved. In chapter 21, Abraham and Abimelech end a period of dispute over access to the well at Beersheba with a treaty. And that treaty brings peace between the two groups. And Isaac and Abimelech do the same thing many years later after a similar dispute over access to wells. And this whole process of making a treaty of peace between the Gentile and the seed of Abraham, that is a blessing that between the two groups can be seen from what Abimelech says to Isaac, I think it would be, in Genesis 26. He says, let's make a treaty with you that you will do us no harm, just as we have not molested you, but have always treated you well and sent you away in peace. And now you are blessed by the Lord. The whole act of making a covenant, a treaty, is an act of blessing, an act of peacemaking. So you have exaltation. You exalt the Abrahamic descendant to a position of a high authority. You have peace treaties. And finally, Gentiles can bless Abraham and his descendants by generously permitting them to live in the best of your land if you're a Gentile. This is obviously in the text that we're looking at, but it's occurred before that. Again, Abimelech and Abraham. Abimelech says to Abraham, my land is before you, live wherever you like, in Genesis 20. And Pharaoh echoes those words in the text that we've looked at today. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best part of the land. So you have treaties, you have the occupation of Gentile land and the recognition of the authority of a descendant of Abraham over Gentile land. These are all, they're all preliminary, they're all proleptic, forward-looking, they're all partial, but nonetheless they're all pointing forward to fuller expressions of how Gentiles are to bless and be blessed. That is, by submitting themselves, their people and their lands to the authority of the Abrahamic descendant, or allowing the Abrahamic descendant to occupy, possess the land. Those sorts of issues, very preliminary, but pointing forward to later biblical theological developments of this motif. Now, the Genesis narrative especially hints at this whole idea that this image of blessing has got tied up in it, the whole idea that you are blessed as a Gentile. You are blessed when you allow the descendant of Abraham to have authority over your realm. An interesting text that picks this up is what happens to Potiphar. Potiphar, we're told in Genesis 39, he put Joseph in charge of his household and of all that he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. And what's going on here, I think, is this little section here in the Potiphar narrative, is that we have a foreshadowing of the blessing that Pharaoh would receive once he put Joseph in charge of his household, his house, his whole land, in fact. So as Joseph rules over Egypt and his family then is later permitted to occupy the best of the lands, Pharaoh is blessed. And in the midst, the way this blessing begins to work itself out is in the midst of the famine, Pharaoh's land is now blessed land because it's ruled over by a descendant of Abraham. And that land, Egypt, surprisingly becomes a land of life, not only to the people of Egypt, but also to the people of the surrounding nations. And then chapter 47, if we had read the rest of it, goes on to describe a specific outworking of Jacob's blessing. We mentioned the Jacob's blessing in a few minutes, but the specific outworking of Jacob's blessing of Pharaoh. And that blessing really recapitulates what has happened earlier in the narrative. And once again, it's a whole idea of the Abrahamic descendant takes the land through famine and gives life to the people and then brings blessing, in fact, to Pharaoh. In the depths of this famine, Joseph keeps Pharaoh's greatest assets, that is the people of Egypt, alive. And when the Egyptians sell their land to Pharaoh in order to buy grain, as chapter 47 verse 20 puts it, all the land, that is all the privately owned land, becomes Pharaoh's. Again, by blessing Abraham's descendants, Pharaoh gets an incredibly great blessing. His people are kept alive, his land is sustained, but he gets even more control over it than he had before. He enters into a very great blessing. So we can enter a little further into this whole idea of what are the specifics of the blessings that come upon qualified Gentiles. We note that Joseph's response to his elevation to the position of high authority in Egypt is to bring life to this land that is in the grip of famine. Here's this land, it is in death's thrall, and Egypt has become the polar opposite of the Garden of Life, the Garden of Eden. And in this situation of death, Joseph emerges as Egypt's savior. In Genesis 41:55, captures this thought that Joseph, by being elevated to this position, is allowed to become Egypt's savior in the midst of death. The whole land of Egypt was famished, so the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all Egypt, "Leku el Yosef, go to Joseph. Whatever he says, do it." So in the midst of all this curse, Joseph will give you life. This is the smart thing about Pharaoh. We have dumb pharaohs and smart pharaohs. We know about the dumb pharaoh, but the smart pharaoh understands how things are, understands who God's chosen people are, and says, "Oh, you need to follow what he says." So he realizes this, that Joseph is the source of life. This is what smart Gentiles do. They understand who is the source of life, which Abrahamic descendants have it, and then go and tell their people, do what he says. And you can see where, if I had time, I'd go with that in terms of developing biblical theology. As you let the Abrahamic descendant rule over your realm, he will give you life out of death. And I guess, in a sense, the message hasn't changed. The gospel we preach is essentially the same as Genesis 3:12, canonically interpreted, of course. If a Gentile, that is anyone outside of spiritual Israel, wants God's blessing, wants life instead of death, then all he or she has to do is bless the seed of Abraham, the seed of Abraham. Enter into a treaty of peace with him. Let him occupy. Now we can have metaphors we could develop. Let him occupy and take possession of the whole of our land. What one would do with that, I'm not exactly sure. But you get the idea of let that seed, let Christ take possession, rule over life, rule over all of our lands. Let him have authority over your territory. Or to rephrase Pharaoh's words, the message, the gospel message that comes out of all this is, if you want to live, go to Jesus. Whatever he says, do it. So there's metaphors there to reflect upon further theological, biblical theological developments of some thoughts in there. Second point is that Jacob blessed Pharaoh. We can be brief here. The mediator, the patriarchs are mediators of life. When blessed by Gentiles, it's their duty, their obligation to pour back onto the Gentiles God's blessing. And we have seen how it happens. One I didn't mention was is the way that Abraham goes out and saves those Canaanites who are captured with Lot. It's Isaac concluding treaties and making peace with the Philistines. It's Joseph rescuing Egypt from death. That's the blessing that patriarchs get to do. But so far in the narrative, Jacob stands outside this process. So far, he's had only one really significant contact with Gentiles, and that was the rape of Tamar. At best, he's a passive player in that incident. When he departs from Shechem, the Gentiles who lived there would hardly feel as though they had been blessed by his presence. It hasn't been very successful, at least from a Gentile point of view. But now at the end of his life, Jacob gets a chance to bless a Gentile. So here's this old guy, feebled and decrepit, he's in his wheelchair, and Joseph wheels him into the presence of the Pharaoh. Now, in one sense, that's not necessary. Pharaoh will be blessed whether Jacob speaks the magic words or not. But I think it's interesting that the narrator wants to bring Jacob into the loop. I wonder if he wants to make the blessing, the Gentile blessing, the process of blessing a Gentile, part and parcel of his definition of what it means to be a true son of Abraham, a true seed of Abraham. And it seems to be also part of the transformation in this man, Jacob, who has now become Israel. The man who started life stealing other people's blessing has now become the quintessential blesser. And not just here, his final days, at least in the narrative, they're days of blessing. Not just here, but chapter 49, where a whole chapter is given over to his blessing of his sons. And now he shows himself in these final days to be, yes, worthy of his name, a true patriarch, a true seed of Abraham, foreshadowing the seed of Abraham who delights to bless Jew and Gentile alike with all the blessings of God. So by becoming a giver rather than a taker of blessing, Jacob now shows himself to be the ideal Israel. Israel, the man and the nation, were mediators of life, were mediators of God's blessing to the nations, or at least they were meant to be. And of course, man, the man Jacob, the man Israel, and the nation Israel as ideals point forward to the even more ideal Israel, Jesus Christ, who is the mediator of blessing, the blessing of life, God's blessing of life to Gentiles like us, dead in sin. Again, there's more room for further reflection there, but we move on. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Pharaoh, Egypt. These are the bad boys of the Old Testament. The Exodus is Egypt's Watergate. It stains Egypt's reputation forever. Just about anyway. After the Exodus, there doesn't seem to be any hope of rehabilitation for Egypt. Pharaoh's opposition to Yahweh and to his people makes Egypt the most convenient model for the archetypal enemy of the people of God. Egypt, that stereotype of wickedness. Egypt, the place to be avoided, conveniently located in the south. So like the pit, like the grave, like Sheol, it is a place that you go down to, and the writers love to play on that. Egypt, the place of wickedness. So why such negative press? Well, that's easy enough. This is the nation that oppressed the people of God. And remember the promise to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. So who cursed the Israelites more than the Egyptians? Well, Balak, in Numbers, he got the leads the Moabites. He has his best shot to try and curse the Israelites, but that's kid stuff in comparison with what the Egyptians did in Egypt. Egypt is the worst, and so they are the most cursed. And the prophets love to dump on Egypt. You know, when you think about it, after the Exodus, Egypt's not really a significant player all that much in Israelite history. It's the local guys, Syria and Moab and those people. They're the first thorns in the flesh of Israel. But as time marches on, it's really it's the Assyrians and the Babylonians. They're the real troublemakers. They're the great oppressors. But nonetheless, through all this period, the prophets always have still got time just to have some invective against Egypt. You're sort of cursing all the nations. Oh, and there's Egypt. We'll hit them as well. It's as if they're saying, Egypt cursed us, and the curse on them remains. And perhaps no prophet curses Egypt with greater force than Ezekiel. And just a quote, I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great monster, lying among your streams. I will pull you out from among your streams. I will leave you in the desert. I will bring a sword against you and kill your men and their animals. Egypt will become a desolate wasteland. I am against you and against your streams, and I will make the land of Egypt a ruin and a desolate waste. I am against you. The words echo through the centuries. Those who cursed the seed of Abraham will themselves be cursed, and so it is with Egypt the oppressor. So Israel's time of slavery casts a long, dark shadow over the patriarchal narratives. Even before the Israelite reader hits the Exodus story, well, they know all about the time of slavery anyway. They already think about Egypt they look at Egypt through jaundiced eyes. Before they even open the book, they regard Egypt as the evil empire. So the writer both accepts and plays with this assessment. When we get to Genesis 12, we hear that Abraham has gone down to Egypt, and we're not surprised to hear that disgusting Egyptian pharaoh has taken Sarah into his harem. What do you expect? He's an Egyptian. And when we hear that God brings diseases on Pharaoh's household for doing this, you say, well, fair enough. You just cast your eyes back a couple of verses. God curses those who curse the people of God. So what do you expect? He deserved it. Yeah, Egypt, the cursed nation. And then to the Joseph narrative, and the stereotypes get reinforced. Joseph is cast into the pit in 37:24, symbolically foreshadowing his imminent descent into that other pit, into Egypt itself. And then look at Potiphar's wife. The one with the voracious sexual appetite. And it's not just enough that their men lust after our women. Where women lust after our men as well. What are they? Some sort of uncontrolled animals. And then the unjust accusations against Joseph. Obviously, there's no justice in Egypt, at least none for the seed of Abraham. And then there's Joseph's time and rotting away in the dungeons of Pharaoh. What do you expect from this country? That's all they ever do to us, we Israelites. That's all they ever do is oppress us. So, of course, they're cursed. Of course, they're this filthy, horrible nation. So the narrative is moving on in this very expected way. They're getting towards telling us about the Exodus, and we expect all this. This is what we would expect of Egypt, the cursed nation. But then the narrative catches us by surprise. One moment, there is Joseph rotting away in the dungeon of Pharaoh, and the next minute we hear Pharaoh saying these words. And he says, you'll be in charge of my palace. Whoa. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He made him ride in his chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, "Make way!" Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. And we say here, hold on, this is out of character. A pharaoh, an Egyptian of the Egyptians, a descendant of a wife stealer and a forebear of a slave driver, blessing a descendant of Abraham, this can't be. And not just once with this story, this passage I've just read, but twice. After chapter 41, Pharaoh sort of fades into the background for a while we get the interplay between Joseph and his brothers and his family. And then finally, we come to the text that we're looking at today, where he comes before Pharaoh, where Joseph comes before Pharaoh once again. Last time he came with an answer. Pharaoh, you need to do this, 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 and this. But now he comes with a question, with a request. Let my family live in Egypt, in Goshen. Now here's a chance for the Egyptian to show his true colors. A chance to show that first time, that first blessing, that was just an aberration. He was dazzled by Joseph's wisdom and his predictions. Now he can think straight. Now he can think like a true Egyptian and send those Israelites packing back to drought-stricken Canaan. Or at least he can say, yeah, you can stay here, but we'll give you the swamp lands. He can be a true Egyptian. No, this guy is completely out of character, at least for an Egyptian, and he does it again. Let them live in Goshen. And as if, just to make the point quite clear, settle your father and brothers in the best part of the land. So here at this point of the narrative, just before Egypt is about to be consigned into the theological netherworld, just before it's about to be tossed onto the Gentile garbage heap, the stereotype is briefly broken. Now, what's the point? Probably more than one. But Israel is, I think one point we can derive from this is Israel is here encouraged to slightly modify their view of Egypt. Whenever Israel thinks of Egypt, it must temper the stereotype with a story of one Egyptian who got it right. One Egyptian who blessed rather than cursed the people of God. The message perhaps is Egypt is not irredeemably wicked. It's a point made here, perhaps, but a point made also in Isaiah 19, where the prophet, at the end of one of these other long oracles of judgment against Egypt, tempers his words with these words. So in that future day, the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians, and in that day, they will acknowledge the Lord. Again, it's not completely dark. There is hope. Not just with this one pharaoh, but maybe in the future. And it's a point that's also made in Acts 2:11. Who hears? Who responds to the good news about life, the good news about blessing that comes from that descendant of Abraham, Jesus Christ? Among that list of descendants, of people that are there listening and responding to the message are residents of Phrygia, Pamphylia, and Egypt. What's the point? Well, one point is that no nation, and ultimately, no individual sinner is utterly beyond hope. No nation, not even the quintessential wicked nations like ancient Egypt, is finally and irrevocably beyond the effectual call of God. Just when you think that a nation or a people is thoroughly intractable in its opposition to God and his people, the Bible sends along, like in this case, the single violation of the prevailing rule, the reminder that even the perennial curses of the people of God can be turned into blessings. Well, this has probably got application. I hope it's got application for those of you who are leaving here. I'm thinking here, boy, Scott, of Suji and Todd aiming to head off to, boy, the modern equivalent of ancient Egypt, Iraq, eventually hoping to get there, ruled by the modern equivalent of Pharaoh, Saddam Hussein. I look at that and say, oh, I'm sorry, that's really dumb. those guys are irredeemably wicked. And I read this story and it says, no, you're the dumb one. Because there's always the exception. There's the good Pharaoh who got it right, who blessed, who's the beginning, the hint of better things yet to come. The hint of what happens in Pentecost. So I hope you guys take that message. Some of you are going out into churches in a couple of months. Hopefully you've got churches. The odds are, if people who tell me these things are correct, you'll end up in what is euphemistically called a revitalization project, a dead church. This message should come as a hope to you. Dead churches, often you're told you go there and your job is to preside over the funeral of the church. No, not necessarily. These stories like this give you hope that there'll be one person there that God is touching, one person who's breaking the stereotype, one person who's the beginning of the blessing, the change that will come at some stage in your ministry. Maybe you have people you've been praying for year in, year out. Think about my grandfather. Year in, year out, my mother in particular prayed for him. Seemed intractable in his opposition to the Lord until about a year or two before he died, when the Lord broke the stereotype, broke the opposition to it in his heart. Or maybe it's just your own sinfulness. You know, there's a certain part of your life that's intractable in its rebellion against God. And you say, well, I guess there's every part of me I can change. Well, there's one area I can't. No. Little messages like this, these surprise stories in the Pentateuch, these surprise stories throughout the Bible, remind us that the exceptions to the stereotype are messages of hope to us that God has not yet finished with the intractable people, the intractable sins in our life, that God can do great things, will do great things. Messages of hope to us. So they're my 3 points. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh.